Hi, I'm Troy Bronsink, and this is From the Hive, a contemplative space where meditative practice meets mindful everyday living. Each episode has two parts, a conversation and a guided meditation. We're connecting you to a variety of contemplative teachers, hearing their story as well as sharing a meditative practice. If you don't have time now to hear their story, just take a look at the show notes for when the meditation portion begins and feel free to skip ahead and come back later to the conversation. Today's conversation is with Daniel Rechtschaffen. He's the author of The Way of Mindful Education, Cultivating Well-Being in Teachers and Students. Daniel grew up at the epicenter of Western mindfulness, where his parents joined Jon Kabat-Zinn in the founding of the Omega Institute. In our discussion, you'll learn how his path evolved from the Omega Institute to psychology to school counselor to his current well-being work with teachers at mindfuleducation.org. You could be doing a million different things right now. You might be on a road trip stuck in the back of the car or cleaning out the stove at home. But wherever you are, I want to invite you for just a second to take a breath, notice the space around you, and enjoy listening. Hopefully you'll be able to sit and meditate with us in the second half. Well, welcome to From the Hive. I'm Troy Bronsink, and today we're with Daniel Rechtschaffen, who is a mindfulness teacher in a number of different ways. It'll be a really interesting conversation, and in specific, we're going to talk about mindfulness and education. So, Daniel, great to have you.
So happy to be here with you, Troy.
Yeah. I'm calling you from a snowy Winter, Ohio, and where are we reaching you?
Reaching me out in the Bay Area in California.
Okay.
Nice and sunny and rainy out here.
All right. Excellent. Daniel and I met a couple months ago at an event at the Hive around education. Interact for Health was real involved with this, and I learned a lot about both what you're doing as an entrepreneur right now, what you're doing in education, and some of your background. And thought maybe we'd start there and just say mindfulness is a particular path. What is it that got you into this this sort of work and your interest around being a facilitator and kind of coach around mindfulness?
Well, I was kind of born into it in an interesting way. I was raised at a place called the Omega Institute, which is a very interesting kind of holistic wellness center in Rhinebeck, New York, where there's a lot of mindfulness and different types of meditation and a lot of stuff around wellness. And my parents founded it. So I kind of grew up amidst, you know, the kind of luminaries such as Jon Kabat-Zinn, who started mindfulness-based stress reduction, and Dan Goleman, who started, you know, really kind of brought up the emotional intelligence work. And so I kind of grew up amidst these practices and was very interested in them from pretty early on. And, I think that a lot of the work, as you said, mainly the work that I do at this point is working with schools and school systems, creating bringing in mindfulness and social emotional learning, basically just creating more healthy learning environments in schools. So on some level, I feel like my work is trying to offer kids the type of healthy environment, mental, emotional, physical environment to grow up in. I was kind of gifted to be given as a child.
That's awesome. So I've got this crazy question then. So how does a teenager rebel against growing up in a mindful home and social environment?
I did my rebelling. I think that my parents never told me to practice mindfulness. They never made me do yoga poses in the morning or anything like that. I think that if they did, I might have become an investment banker or something like
right,
that.
Right. Yeah.
I think that I had my wild kind of rebellious teenage years, but I never really rebelled from the practices or the kind of philosophy that they were teaching just around, you know, how to be kind to each other, how to be present, how to be aware of what's inside and what's around me, because it wasn't forced on me. It mm-hmm. was more just kind of the environment that I grew up in. So I didn't feel like I had to. I, of course, had, as everybody has to, I had to kind of individuate and become my own person and figure out the way who I wanted to be in the world, mm-hmm. which I could, you know, go into my own life journey of how I did that. But in terms of the basic underlying kind of philosophy of mindfulness, that wasn't something I felt like I had to fight against.
What was it that made you, in your journey then, that lets you kind of go like, education's going to be the place for this, for where you want to do this work? I know that you were a therapist for a while. Is that right?
I was. Yeah. It's interesting how, you know, we choose some things on our journey, and there's some things in our journey that choose us. So I went to school studying philosophy. You know, I just, ever since I was very young, I've been just very fascinated in the mind and the world and, you know, how things work. And so I studied philosophy, and after that, when I was working as, you know, pouring coffee as a philosopher, I realized I need to, how am I going to get paid for this? And I realized, you know, the only kind of way that I felt like in our modern society that I could, you know, do work around helping people be more aware and compassionate was to be a therapist. And mm-hmm. so I studied psychology and ended up doing an internship for a few years as a school therapist. And, you know, I'd been practicing, getting very into mindfulness myself and doing a lot of intensive mindfulness training for, you know, just exploring my own awareness. And at that time, which was more than 10 years ago, with the kids I was working with, I was seeing what most, you know, parents and teachers and folks out there who work with kids or have kids see, that, you know, there's the rising epidemic of attentional issues and anxiety and all of the, you know, the kind of scary things we see of the percentages of kids that are at younger and younger ages that are really struggling emotionally. And so I started using these mindfulness practices, you know, basic relaxation techniques, attention techniques, emotional regulation, really just trying to support kids in some basic ways without knowing if anybody else had ever really tried this with kids before. Mm-hmm. And was getting some really amazing results, kids really being able to utilize the practices. I mean, at first they thought it was kind of weird, and slowly I had to realize like how to teach these through fun, interesting games. Mm-hmm. And once I learned how to teach it in a more accessible way, you know, I saw kids really taking the practices for themselves and utilizing them. And around that time, there's some organizations that started doing it that I became aware of, an organization called Mindful Schools in the Bay Area, a woman named Susan Kaiser Greenland, who had something called Inner Kids in Los Angeles, a woman named Linda Lentieri, who has something called the Inner Resilience Program in New York, and I started working with them a lot, you know, putting on some conferences, doing a bunch of collaborative work, and really kind of jumped on the surfboard right in the beginning mm-hmm. as this became a movement. And, you know, I was just so inspired by the idea of being able to bring these kind of basic wellness practices in for kids who are really struggling. And actually have the opportunity to bring them in on a kind of systemic level in schools. And so it inspired me, and I've just kind of been on the ride ever since as it's becoming a more and more big kind of even policy level thing that's starting to happen.
Wow. Well, you're describing this systemic level. Mindful education is a project you're doing specifically for teachers as opposed to going specifically to kids. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, you know, I've in the arc of what I've been doing, as I said, I started working individually with kids, and then I started working in classrooms throughout Oakland and Berkeley and San Francisco, and then pretty quickly I saw after a couple of years, you know, that it was great for me to be going and teaching this in the classrooms, but it, you know, to get the teachers and the principals to be able to embody their own mindfulness practice and to be able to teach it themselves would be so much more beneficial. There's actually been a bunch of research that's done recently that, you know, when you train teachers how to practice their own mindfulness, self-compassion, all of these, you know, really healthy things, that not only does it help the teachers, but it actually really helps the kids. Even if the kids aren't taught anything, just to have a teacher who's more relaxed, present, and caring, the kids actually, they kind of learn that through osmosis. So I really shifted into most of my work being training teachers how to teach this to kids. So the program I'm doing online, and this has really come out of, you know, I have a lot of schools and school districts that, even how I got to know you is that the Cincinnati schools invited me out to give a talk to them about how to help bring this work into their schools. But what I really started realizing is that schools are so stressed and with little time and little money and all these things that I started working with a lot of colleagues figuring out how can we create an online learning platform that's really accessible, that's really supportive to schools and school systems so that you can offer it, you know, to every teacher, every administrator in the school for them to learn their own mindfulness practice and then to give them kind of some basic curriculum training of how to teach it to the kid.
That's perfect. So for a second then, because I imagine this is some of what you do then, is demystify what this kind of San Francisco mindfulness-ism, how does it make it into the Midwest? I'll give you a case here. So my wife's a speech therapist at a Cincinnati school that has a lot of kids with kind of economic and other risk factors, that there was a kindergarten class with just kids with multiple different types of trauma survivors and different types of emotional capacity challenges. And you could just kind of feel it always at the brim of kind of exploding, and the challenge for this teacher to just kind of keep it all together. And so the notion of escaping into a spa sounds great, but you're talking about some other compromise and skill set and whatnot. So for a little bit, just kind of demystify what does that process look like for a teacher? What's happening like physiologically with kids and with teachers when they're taking some responsibility for this process?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, the example that you used, which is a great example because, you know, that might be a heightened example of, population of kids, but it's, I mean, I'm working with plenty of private, you know, privileged schools where it's actually a very similar experience of teachers who are really stressed. I think the average right now is that a teacher, a teacher stays for 3 years in the teaching profession, which is terrible. And I experience it. I go into the classrooms and I see, you know, teachers who are just deeply burned out and, you know, deeply stressed. It's a very stress-producing place. So that's often, you know, when we're talking about the physiology and the practices, we could just start with the idea of stress. Basically, we're kind of like orienting somebody towards their nervous system. So the first step in a mindfulness practice is we're trying to, and whether it's for teachers or for kids, first, we want them to be able to just be able to track within themselves what's going on in terms of their stress levels. For kids, I have this what I call like a stress thermometer, where I'm trying to help them to recognize where they are on their stress level, because oftentimes we end up kind of operating at like 5 or 6 or 7 on the stress level. We don't even realize, though, that we're that high up. And so we're so close to burnout and we're grinding the gears, basically. So on that physiological level, there's all types of things we could go into about, you know, how much some people think that almost 50% of medical visits are actually stress related, you know, like are actually from, it becomes physical because the stress produces, you know, so much different types of pains, or, you know, it's been tied to eczema and it's been tied to, you know, anxiety, and it's been, you know, both emotional and physical disorders that arise from grinding on those gears for so long. So, wow. You know, the basic practices that we start with are, first, we want to help people just to be able to be aware of what's going on inside of their bodies, right? So where is the tension? Where is the stress? Just notice, having them do these basic physical, what I call physical literacy. So we begin with physical literacy, noticing how much tension is there, how much stress is there. Building the mental literacy, which is witnessing our thoughts and how much we get caught in this kind of hamster wheel of thoughts. Very often now, when we talk about anxiety and depression in psychology, there's a lot of talk about where we're actually thinking of those disorders more as thinking disorders than emotional disorders, because there's a way that we get caught in this kind of rumination spin in our minds. And what mindfulness really does is it helps us first to notice how the mind is spinning. It helps us be able to notice where that feeling is in the body, like how stressed we are in the body, and bringing the mind and the body together so that we can feel our emotions and we can do some of these very basic breathing, relaxation, self-compassion practices, where we can feel a way to be able to resolve and bring some kind of healing to our experience. So finding a still point in all of the chaos. So that's the first step. If we're just talking about stress, is how to de-stress, how to be able to be a life preserver for the rest of our kids. But then the next step, I just did those, you know, physical, mental, emotional literacies. I have five literacies. Then the fourth and fifth are the social literacy and a kind of global literacy. And I'm very interested in that, because the reason I'm very interested to work with schools is, of course, what we're doing, you know, physiologically, we're wanting to work with stress, with self-compassion, with the sense of kind of wellness of how to help a teacher and a kid to be able to be more regulated within a kind of chaotic situation. Mm-hmm. But of course, in the long run, we want the kind of social and global and systemic experience not to be so stressful. We don't just want people to be able to cope with a stressful situation. We actually want to figure out, how do we make the school system, how do we work with it to make it more equitable, to make it more relaxing, to make it more fun, to make it more interesting? So first we deal with, you know, how do we take responsibility for what's going on inside. And then once we do that, then I'm even more interested, how do we work as a community to actually cultivate a more healthy environment?
That's really fascinating. So it reminds me a little bit that one of the things I wanted to ask you about is this notion of kind of socially how mindfulness is understood, and particularly in a combative world where there's a lot of triggers, whether they're triggers to, like, am I responsible for all the things that make me angry in the world, or is somebody else responsible for that? And even religious triggers of, like, oh, is that something that they do, and I need to have my own way of doing this? So I've heard you say some interesting things before around the mindfulness not being a particularly religious practice. And I'd love to hear you say a little bit more about that.
Definitely. It's utterly important right now to get into the specifics of what mindfulness is. So if we look at, mindfulness on some level of what we're talking about now is relatively new. In the last, 30 years or so, it's really become some. But if you read any book from 40, 50, 60, 100 years ago, people use the word being mindful all the time. This is not a new idea. Mm-hmm. Every single religious, spiritual, just cultural, even indigenous tradition, the idea of mindfulness is just a human capacity. It's the human capacity to pay attention, to be and particularly to pay attention in a kind of open-hearted way. So the basic faculty of mindfulness is to really be attuned to what is happening right now in the present moment. And that sounds like, often when people hear that, it sounds like, well, that's the, simplest thing in the world. But the moment you start practicing it and you try to just pay attention in a kind of open-hearted way to your breath or to somebody that you're talking to, we see how hard it actually is. Our mind gets distracted, we get pulled away, we get caught in thoughts, that practice of being able to be attuned to the present moment, to our own children, to ourselves, to whatever it is, that is just a human faculty that if you read any religious practice or anything anywhere, you know, it's what people most deeply value is just being able to be kind and present. When it gets into what's important to look at is that every single tradition in the world has had ways that helped to build that faculty like a muscle. So it's like, let's build these attention muscles, these kindness muscles. And of course, Christianity has all types of ways. How do we be more compassionate? You know, how do we be more present? And one of the traditions, which often, you know, people talk about or worry about with the mindfulness movement is around Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And the reason that is because Buddhism is actually the most Buddhist tradition, it actually is really not much of a religion. It's more of a psychology. It's most of what is happening in those traditions is they've for 2,500 years worked really diligently to figure out how to do these practices, whether it's walking really slowly or whether it's breathing really consciously or whether it's opening the heart up to others. It's really this kind of psychology of how do we attune this mindful capacity. So a lot of the Buddhist tradition have really come up with these skills for building mindfulness. So it is true that when we look at the modern mindfulness tradition, a lot of the practices we use have been informed by that Buddhist history, mm-hmm. but the practices are totally non-religious. They say nothing about Buddha. They say nothing about any kind of dogma. And most of those practices have been done in Christianity or Judaism or all types of Taoism or wherever, because they're basically, you know, watching your breath, using the breath as an anchor point. Every tradition does that. But it is true, and it's why people get a little worried, is that when they look at some of these practices, it looks a little like Buddhism, because it has been, you know, the tradition has drawn a lot from the wisdom of Buddhism. But there's nothing, if you like look at my trainings or other people's mm-hmm. trainings, there's zero in there around Buddhism, around wanting people to be a specific religion. And it's very clear that, because I actually have a whole Catholic school district that is using my training, and mm-hmm. I think it's very, mindfulness supports whatever tradition you are, whatever philosophy you have. You know, if you're a Christian, it helps you be able to be a better Christian, because it helps you to pay attention and to open your heart to be able to do whatever practice you are. So there's zero religious connotations, but it is an important thing to break apart.
Yeah, clarifying that. We've had an interesting discussion with Maya Durr, who is a Zen Buddhist teacher, and she did kind of describe how mindfulness operates within a tradition because there's an ethic to it. And then I hear you describing a similar type of ethic, which is that there's self-awareness, but then there's other awareness, and that global awareness, and that those things are tied together. And then, you know, at the Hive, we have a number of classes from different traditions. We'll have Sufi mystics talk about their breathing exercises, and folks from my tradition that are, you might teach centering prayer or other Christian breathing exercises, and then yoga teachers and mindfulness teachers as well. So I think it is interesting how knowing the importance of a practice then can reinforce these other social, faith, and ethic and moral places that you kind of arrive at ahead of time, and then these kind of deepen that.
And it's because it seems, and I appreciate, you know, you bring up Sufism, which, you know, is a kind of branch of Islam, and there's so much kind of like in the news and modern politics around Islam, and But of course, every human being or every culture everywhere, there is people that are, you know, we live in community. We want to be able to be good with our, you know, teach our children well and to live well. And everywhere people have lived, they've needed to learn how to focus better and be more compassionate. And mm-hmm. So if you look at a lot of those Sufi practices, they're, you know, they're profound mindfulness practices. They're teaching how to be able to, center in the heart and to be, you know, focused in the body and to be open-hearted to the whole world. And if you look in, of course, centering prayer all around the world, people have come up, you know, we've had the same bodies, we've had the same minds. They work rather similarly. So people have figured out everywhere how to be able to be better people.
Yeah. In a second, we're going to invite you to guide us in a practice. But before we do that, I'd be curious if you would say a little bit about like your day-to-day rhythm as an entrepreneur, working in education and all of that. I'd imagine that includes some travel and kind of these fairly non-routine schedules. How do you take your practice into that? What is it like to have a mobile, flexible practice in your own life?
It's a practice. I just returned from being in Europe for a few weeks teaching a lot. This mindfulness and social emotional learning movement is really big in. I was in Germany and Austria and Switzerland and France, and it's actually becoming a very global thing. Mm-hmm. Waking up in a hotel room and for me, I think that it's really important to find the mindfulness practice that works for you rather than like thinking that it's supposed to look a certain way. For me, over the, almost 20 years I've been practicing in different ways, one of my main practices is doing some different type of movement practices, and like a Qigong type practice, which is something that for me, when I wake up, it's really important. I mean, my body just loves these type of like basic movements to align me and so I never really miss that. I've found a lot of people who try to wake up and sit still in the morning. Mm-hmm. Some people that works very well. For some people if you're like sitting and being deeply frustrated trying to force yourself to do it. For a lot of people, especially in our modern fast-paced world, it works a lot better to do some kind of movement practices. Usually I do some movement and then I sit for a little while. It kind of helps me be more aligned. And then my mindfulness practices, I feel like I try to make everything a mindfulness practice. So, you know, it's also being a therapist, which I still do, is a mindfulness practice. You know, it's this practice of learning how to be really attuned to a human being when I'm in discussion with them, or learning how to walk through this ancient German city where I'm looking at these cobblestone streets and being aware of the bells from the church chiming. And I think it's really important to have an actual practice where you're practicing, but then, you know, the main point is to get into the game and to actually be attuned and present to what's happening in the world.
Well, awesome. We're going to get into the, we've been in the game. We're going to get into the practice in a second here. We've been talking with Daniel Rechtschaffen and with Mindful Education. And in a moment, we'll take a break here and then we'll be back and share a practice together. Hey there, you've been listening to From the Hive, a contemplative space where meditative practice meets mindful everyday living. I'm your host, Troy Bronsink, founder and director of The Hive, a center for contemplation, art, and action. This episode is part of a 5-episode mini-season, and if you have any recommendations or if you're interested in advertising, you can email me at troy@sensihive.org.
Now, The Hive is a nonprofit located in the North Side neighborhood of Cincinnati. Our secret sauce is outfitting people to take up a daily practice through this 6 to 8 week peer-to-peer groups or through events with luminaries in the arts and in community and yoga and spirituality and more. You can check out our website at cincyhive.org for more info on how to get involved.
Welcome back to From the Hive. I'm Troy Bronsink, and today we're with Daniel Rechtschaffen, and he is the director, founder of Mindful Education, and we've been talking about how mindfulness and education mingle, and specifically ways that that practice of mindfulness can have both kind of personal benefit for educators and other folks, as well as begin to translate into awareness in our participation in social environments and teachers' participation in the class and a number of those sort of things. Daniel, it's been good to be with you.
Yeah, it's been great.
If you would, I'd just invite you. One of our practices with this podcast is just inviting our guests to guide us in a practice. And so as we do that, I'm going to step back here and put myself on mute and just join you in the practice. But would you begin by kind of giving folks a little context of the space you're in and inviting them to be aware of their space, and then just kind of move us into the practice, please?
Of course. So welcome, everybody. Happy to have a chance to practice with all of you. When I'm teaching, I teach around these five literacies of mindfulness. So being aware of the body, the mind, the heart, our social world, and our global world. So I always like to start with being aware of the body, the physical literacy. We're such a mental-based culture that it's really important to land first. Especially, I know this from education, until kids feel safe and relaxed and having fun, it's hard to learn. It's hard to be present. So let's orient ourselves to this present moment, this physical body that each of us have. So I'm sitting here in rainy California, looking out at some beautiful plum tree with these red fall leaves still on it. And if you in your wherever you are, you can just kind of take a moment to look around, see where you are. Just kind of take in the experience of the colors, of the shapes, of the smells. Just kind of be where you are. Orient. And then what we can do is we can just kind of check into our physical systems, landing in our bodies. And a great way we could do that is to really orient to the full physical experience. And what we'll do is we'll be aware of our skin, you know, the part of the body that's in contact with the outer world. And then our flesh, and then our bones. So we're going to do a kind of little body scan where we're just going to drop into the somatic experience. So if you want, you can let the eyes close, or you can look down a little bit. And can begin by giving the body kind of an upright posture. It's always really important when doing a sitting mindfulness practice to begin by giving the body this kind of channel, this upright channel. And a way that you could start that is as you breathe in, you could get a sense that your spine is like elongating upwards. Out here in California, I use the metaphor of a redwood tree, so as if the spine grows up tall into the sky. And then as you breathe out, as if the roots drop down into the earth, letting the body relax, the muscles relax. So why don't we try a few of those breaths? Every in-breath, the spine gets tall. There's this sense of upright focus. And then every exhale, there's a sense of relaxed, kind of dropping in. And then you can just find that balance between an upright body and a relaxed body. And then you could see if you could bring your attention to your skin. We could start with the head, maybe the top of the head, the forehead, and see if you can notice, is there a temperature, are there itches, vibrations, just kind of noticing without trying to find anything specific. Just see if you can feel the top of your head. And you can just kind of continue to explore. You can explore the face, the eyebrows, the nose, the cheeks. And you can feel the air touching you. And in your own time, we can just kind of slowly move through the body, down the neck. Just feeling the outer edge of the skin, maybe down to the clothing that you're wearing on your shoulders. And seeing if you can keep that attention and keep kind of like a deep fascination. One thing I often say with kids is I have them close their eyes and I have them look at their hand and then I say, okay, now close your eyes and how do you know your hand is still there? So since you're not looking at your arms, how do you know that your arms are there? See if you can just feel the experience of the arms, the touch of the cloth of your clothing, feeling how different parts of the skin feel differently, kind of moving down all the way to the hands. Maybe moving back up and feeling the chest. It's kind of slowly moving down the body, the upper back, moving through the body, just noticing what the skin feels like. The skin and its contact with the outer world. There's so much information that your body is signaling you with all the time. It's like your body, your skin is speaking to you. Going all the way down through the hips. Down through the legs. Kind of seeing if you can sweep through and sweeping with your awareness, as if your awareness is located down in the legs, noticing the temperature, the weight, tightness or relaxed, all the way down through the feet, just getting the sensations of the skin everywhere. And then the next step is we could start up at the head again and we can see if we can start noticing inside the skin. So you could notice even like inside your mouth, maybe your tongue or your, you know, the skin in your cheeks or even your brain. You could feel, you know, what's inside that skin, the flesh. Kind of see if you can slowly move down the body, down through the neck, noticing the muscles inside the neck. Starting to feel if you can, kind of like you're looking with a microscope, see if you can notice the sensations beneath the skin, the tendons, down through the shoulders and the arms, getting the kind of the musculature, maybe even the blood pumping. See if you can get how those sensations are different from the skin. You can even go up to the chest and the back and you can feel inside, you can feel the organs, the heart beating, the lungs going in and out, the stomach gurgling. See if you can slowly move down the body, kind of feeling into the flesh of the body. And it might feel comfortable, it might feel uncomfortable, and without needing to change anything or do anything, just seeing if you can sweep down through the body, noticing sensory experience of the organs, of the muscles, of the blood, down through the legs. And then let's do one more sweep, feeling into the bones. So if you begin again, we can feel, see if you can feel your skull. And kind of the shape and the feel of your skull and your jaw and your getting into that. If you can actually feel what the bones feel like, if you really focus in, you can get, there's this kind of more dense sensory experience of the bone. You could check again. Oh yeah, what does the skin feel like? What do the muscles feel like? And if you go really deep inside, what does the bone feel like? You could feel the spine and maybe kind of track down the vertebra. What do those vertebra feel like? What do the ribs feel like? And you get the bone, the marrow inside the bone. You can get kind of the whole frame, getting the arms, the hand bones, those little finger bones, seeing if you can really feel the kind of structure of your bones and the sensations of the bones. Slowly sweeping down in your own time, feeling the different bones. Down through the legs, the hips. Those kind of thick sit bones and hip bones. Down through the legs and the feet and the little tiny toe bones. And then feeling the entire bone structure. Just feeling yourself as a skeleton. And then again, from that skeleton, you can add awareness of the flesh, add awareness of the skin. And then for a minute, just see if you can be fully aware of all of the sensations in your body, the bones, the flesh, the skin, this kind of this big like beehive of sensations. And as you do it, you can even add the awareness of the outside world, the room you're in, the world around the room. So you can sit with this sensory kind of buzz in the body, as well as this awareness of everything around you. And just sitting for a moment, just feeling yourself right here, right now, in your body, in your world. And when you're ready, you can let the eyes open, but don't stop practicing. See if you can, when you're finished with this practice, you can keep this level of awareness of the body, of the bones and flesh and skin, and see if you can walk out into your world, whatever you're doing next, even if you're typing on the computer. See if you can stay with this level of awareness as you live through the rest of your day.
Well, thanks, Daniel. It's appreciate you holding the space with us and walking us through all that. What are the best ways for folks to stay in touch with you and the work that you're doing?
The best way is you can go to mindfuleducation.com or danielrechtschaffen.com. And I have a couple books out, The Way of Mindful Education and The Mindful Education Workbook, which both, give a lot more kind of clear understanding of the work that I'm doing. And if you go to mindfuleducation.com, it brings you into my online learning platform, which for educators is a really great way to be able to explore all this work and to integrate it into the work you're doing.
Well, excellent. I'm sure we'll get the chance to hear more from you over the years to come. Really excited for all that you're doing, and appreciate you spending time with us here from the Hive. Thanks, folks, for listening. I'm Troy Bronsink, your host, and we're pleased to just create space for you to develop a contemplative practice and see how that would integrate into your life and work. Thanks for being with us.
I'm Troy Bronsink, and this has been From the Hive, a contemplative space where meditative practice meets mindful everyday living. Today, we've been talking with Daniel Rechtschaffen. You can check out the show notes for ways to connect further with his work. This has been the final episode of our 5-episode mini-season, and we're planning on returning as soon as possible to share more conversations with practitioners. As always, if you have any recommendations or questions, feel free to email me at troy@cincyhive.org. And if you're in the Cincinnati area, consider dropping by the Hive. We're in the Northside neighborhood. You can find more information about us at www.cincyhive.org or at our Facebook or Instagram page. Meanwhile, take a deep breath and enjoy your day.